Today is Tuesday, June 8th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg visits the U.S. Pentagon.
Turning NATO not just into a military alliance, but as a political platform to counter some of what Russia and some of what China are doing in terms of trying to shift the balance of power for the world.
Plus, support for keeping France's anti-terrorism operation in the Sahel is fading.
Both in France and in the countries where it operates.
We'll have these stories and more next. NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg visited the U.S. Pentagon Monday to meet with U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin. During a press conference, Stoltenberg discussed the challenges facing not only NATO, but the world.
I realize that we need to invest in our security to make sure that we continue to be able to deliver credible deterrence and defense in a more unpredictable and competitive world.
VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden has been following the Secretary General's visit. He began our conversation by providing an update on NATO's withdrawal from Afghanistan.
The Secretary General said that the withdrawal is on pace, that it's on track for the early September deadline, which is similar to what we've heard from Pentagon officials as well, who have said that the U.S. portion of the withdrawal is almost 50% complete, and there have been hints that the U.S. could be completely out of Afghanistan much sooner than the September 11th deadline that was set by President Joe Biden. The focus for NATO's part of the withdrawal, though, has been on the safety and the security of its forces as they leave. That has also been on track and so far not been a problem. The interesting thing is that the Secretary General said that with all of this, there is a risk that withdrawing from Afghanistan entails risk, that there's uncertainty. And of course, there's been a lot of concern voiced by critics, both on the right and the left, of the withdrawal from Afghanistan, that it's going to leave the Afghan government in an indefensible position where it and its security forces could potentially fall to the Taliban. A UN report released just last week suggested that Taliban commanders, while they talk outwardly of participating in inter-Afghan negotiations, that they've been positioning their forces so what they cannot get at the negotiating table, they can simply take with military force, and that some top Taliban commanders actually favor using military force instead of negotiations.
The Secretary General also said that the global balance of power is shifting with the rise of China and that NATO sees Russia continuing to be responsible for aggressive actions against NATO itself and its allies. What more did the Secretary General have to say?
This is a theme that Jens Stoltenberg has been echoing time and time again over the last several weeks and even going back further about where NATO has to go in order to continue to be an effective alliance. He talks about it as part of the NATO 2030 plan that he's been pitching and that will come up for discussion when NATO leaders meet next week. And a lot of that has to do with, in his words, turning NATO not just into a military alliance, but as a political platform to counter some of what Russia and some of what China are doing in terms of trying to shift the balance of power for the world. And so he's been promoting a need for NATO to come together and push back against that. And that means being not just a military alliance and standing up to Russian aggression and Russian malign activity, as he pointed to in Ukraine, what he pointed to in Belarus, where a plane the other week was forced to land. And so there's a lot that he says needs to be done. And at the same time, it's challenging because he says that with Russia, for example, NATO is pursuing a dual-track policy. While they're going to contest Russia, they do not want to see conflict with Russia, and therefore it's essential to talk and it's essential to be a strong political force on the world stage.
Stoltenberg not only talked about aggression in the physical realm, but also in the digital space. He mentioned that a cyber attack on a NATO ally could, in fact, potentially trigger Article 5, the Mutual Self-Defense Agreement. Can you explain more about what he said, and did he give any specific examples?
This is something that Stoltenberg has been speaking up about more and more in recent weeks, and being somewhat vague about it as well, saying that, well, the alliance has decided that a cyber attack could trigger the mutual defense clause in the NATO alliance. He says he's not going to talk publicly about what the threshold is, what exactly a malign actor or a foreign adversary like a China or a Russia might need to do in order to trigger that. But we've also heard from the United States, even on Tuesday, in the White House National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, how even from a point of view of NATO and from a U.S.-European point of view, that there needs to be more of a coming together in order to better protect the cyber systems that are critical to Western infrastructure, whether on the U.S. side of the Atlantic or the European side of the Atlantic.
Jeff, speaking of critical infrastructure, I understand that there is a pretty significant update on the ransomware that was paid out by Colonial Pipeline.
The big news came from the U.S. Justice Department and the FBI, which announced that they had managed to basically snatch back from DarkSide, the Russian-based criminal network that launched the ransomware attack against Colonial Pipeline, which led to a shutdown of gas pipelines up and down the U.S. East Coast and causing shortages at gas stations along the East Coast. And they were able to go in, track the ransomware payment by working with the company that came under attack, Colonial Pipeline, and they recovered a majority of the ransom payment in Bitcoin that was given to DarkSide. The Deputy Assistant Attorney General said at a news conference that approximately 75 Bitcoin that were paid out to DarkSide, that they recovered 67. The Justice Department said this is a sign that they can go after and they can bring resources to bear and deprive criminal networks of what they seek most when it comes to ransomware attacks.
Jeff Selden is VOA's national security correspondent. The United States Supreme Court says thousands of immigrants living in the U.S. for humanitarian reasons cannot apply to become permanent residents. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani explains.
A unanimous high court says federal immigration law bans people who entered the country illegally and now have what's called temporary protected status from seeking green cards. The case hinged on whether those people were actually admitted to the U.S. under immigration law. Justice Elena Kagan says they were not, writing for the court in a case that pitted the Biden administration against immigrant groups who argued many of the people in question have lived in the U.S. for years and put down roots. The House has passed a bill making it possible for TPS recipients to become permanent residents, but the Senate prospects are unclear. Sagar Magani, Washington.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. Since the brutal civil war in Ethiopia's Tigray region began in November, many healthcare centers in the area have been looted and destroyed. Parents often have to travel for weeks to get care for their children injured in the battles. VOA's Heather Murdoch has more.
Some of the children in this hospital ward traveled for weeks to get here after being shot, knifed, or hit by shrapnel in the ongoing war in Ethiopia's Tigray region. 15-year-old Bariha Gebrey has lost one eye and is permanently blind in the other.
She and her cousin went out to play in the yard. Suddenly, they saw people running. They also ran, and they were both shot.
It took Gebrey weeks to get to this hospital in the regional capital, Makala, as they traveled from town to town, trying to find a clinic to treat her. He says everywhere he went, he found health centers destroyed and looted. After the fighting stopped, the nurse for this clinic in Ediga Hamas returned to find a burnt-out tank, bullet-riddled signs, and dead soldiers on the streets. Like so many others, her clinic was empty.
Yes, I came and the door is opened. The glass are broken and the equipment are stolen. Nothing here.
Patients, including children and victims of rape, still come to her with war injuries, but there is very little she can do.
Emergency medicines were there. It was stolen, and some is here, infusions, and dressing, suturing. All the equipment are stolen here.
Tefatowicz says she refers patients to the few hospitals in the main cities where medical workers say they are short of supplies in every department. In the Eider Hospital in Mekelle, some children say losing their limbs has been less painful than losing their loved ones.
My older brother was with me. He was injured and died.
The Ethiopian government says it takes very seriously its responsibility to alleviate the suffering of the people in the Tigray region. The government blames the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front for the war that began last November after a coordinated attack on its forces in the region. But many people in Tigray say the region is under attack from federal forces, Eritrean forces, and Amhara militias. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Mekelle and Adugahamas, Ethiopia.
A promise Monday by Mali's new interim president to hold democratic elections by early next year appears to meet some conditions set by France to resume recently suspended cooperation with Malian forces. But some hope Paris is slowly heading for an exit when it comes to its years-long anti-terrorist operation in the Sahel. Lisa Bryant is up next.
France's announcement last week that it was halting counterinsurgency cooperation with Malian forces followed Mali's second coup in less than a year. President Emmanuel Macron denounced the power grab as unacceptable, warning also that he would pull French troops from Mali altogether if it tipped to radical Islam. Sworn in as Mali's latest interim president days later, junta leader Assimi Goïta vowed to preserve his country's democratic gains and meet promises to hold elections by next February. Not everyone believes him.
I think that Assimi Goïta is trying to reassure the international public opinion and international partners. But in the meantime, since the first transition, we see that the military try to keep themselves in power. And the last coup is an illustration of this voluntary to stay in power.
Bakary Sambe is director of the Timbuktu Institute Research Group. He says while Goïta and his military junta are under pressure, so too is Macron, as he eyes next year's presidential elections at home and sharpens his anti-terrorism rhetoric. Support for keeping France's 8-year-old 5,100-man Barkhane anti-terrorism operation in the Sahel is fading, both in France and in the countries where it operates, as anti-French sentiment is mounting. Meanwhile, Sambe says some Malians support Goïta and the idea of holding talks with at least some armed groups in the country, which France rejects.
Venturing sanctions against the junta will be perceived as a double punishment against the Malian who already doubt the effectiveness of the action of the international community, which has neither defeated terrorism nor stabilized Mali.
Meanwhile, here in France, some hope the suspension of cooperation with Mali's army will be the first step to a bigger drawdown and eventual French military exit from the Sahel, a vast area edging the Sahara Desert that is rife with instability. Others say they aren't so sure that will happen. French anti-terrorism specialist Marc-Antoine Pérouse de Monclos says no other forces in the region can take France's place. Meanwhile, he told France's TV5 Monde channel that militants are profiting from the security void. And he notes Mali isn't France's only partner in the Sahel counterinsurgency effort. A broader so-called G5 coalition also includes Mauritania, Chad, Niger, and Burkina Faso. A case in point is Burkina Faso, where suspected Islamist militants killed at least 160 people early Saturday. French Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian heads to Ouagadougou this week to show France's solidarity, illustrating the bigger ties binding France to a complicated conflict. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Nearly 7 years after Malaysian Airlines Flight 17 was shot down over eastern Ukraine, the trial in a Dutch court of three Russians and a Ukrainian accused of involvement in its downing has moved to the crucial merits phase, when evidence will be discussed by the lawyers and judges. The AP's Zaria Shackley has that story.
Families of some of the victims were present in court to watch the latest hearing in the long-running case. The trial that has progressed through a series of preliminary hearings since opening in March 2020 will in the coming days begin examining the huge case file pieced together after a years-long international investigation. The four suspects were not in the courtroom. They are being tried in their absence. They face life sentences if convicted of murdering the 298 people who died when the flight from Amsterdam to Kuala Lumpur was blown out of the sky above conflict-torn eastern Ukraine. I'm Zeria Shakili.
Negotiating solutions to the global work crisis triggered by the COVID-19 pandemic will be at the center of discussions at the International Labor Conference over the next 2 weeks. Some 4,700 delegates from 176 countries have registered to attend this conference, held virtually for the first time because of the pandemic. Lisa Schlein takes it from here.
During his opening remarks, Director General of the International Labor Organization, Guy Ryder, told his largely invisible audience that global action was required to overcome what he called the cataclysmic impact of COVID-19 on the world of work. He said this work crisis was four times as severe as the one triggered by the financial crisis of 2008 and 2009. He said 255 million full-time jobs had been lost last year because of the pandemic, wiping out $3.7 trillion of labor income.
108 million people pushed back into working poverty, and the most vulnerable and already disadvantaged hit hardest. Young people, women, informal workers, migrants. The pandemic has confronted us with unbearable brutality, with the reality and consequences of the multiple and growing inequalities in our societies.
Ryder notes the pandemic has worsened the inequalities that already existed. He said they have hardened into deep structural injustice, widening the fairness gap between the rich and poor countries. He said all societies have suffered unbearable loss in health and wealth. But he said recovery from the pandemic was now underway in wealthy countries that have access to life-saving vaccines. These countries, he added, can look forward to getting back quite rapidly to pre-pandemic levels of GDP.
But for low-income countries and most of the developing world, the prospects are starkly different. The fact is that gross inequities in vaccine distribution and vastly different fiscal firepower would inject a double dose of more inequality into the world of work, with a booster from uneven digital connectivity. That is, unless deliberate action is taken to prevent it.
ILO Chief Ryder noted this terrible global crisis required a global response. He said only effective international cooperation and action can close the growing divide between the have and have-not countries. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Pakistani officials say that at least 51 people were killed and more than 100 others were injured in a train collision in southern Sindh province on Monday. It's the latest accident to highlight the perilous state of a more than 165-year-old railway system. Reuters' Saroya Ali has more.
Rescuers struggle to reach people trapped in mangled compartments scattered across the tracks in the southern province of Sindh. Military helicopters flew overhead to carry the wounded passengers. A Pakistan railway spokesman said several carriages of one train fell across the adjacent track after a derailment in the Ghotki district. A second train coming from the other direction then smashed into them. Prime Minister Imran Khan said on Twitter he was shocked by the horrific accident and was ordering a comprehensive investigation into railway safety. Accidents on the decrepit system are common. In 2005, in the same district, about 130 people were killed when a crowded passenger train rammed into another at a station and a third train hit the wreckage.
Saroya Ali from Reuters. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The head of the United Nations Nuclear Watchdog Agency accused Iran Monday of failing to answer questions about the discovery of uranium particles at undeclared nuclear sites in the country.
After many months, Iran has not provided the necessary explanation, and I'm deeply concerned about this. So we hope that we are going to be able to make progress. I'm concerned that the technical discussions between us and Iran have not yielded what I expected by now. And I have reiterated to my Iranian colleagues here and to authorities in Tehran their requirement for Iran to clarify and to resolve these issues without further delay. Why? Because the lack of progress in clarifying them seriously affects our ability to provide assurance of the peaceful nature of Iran's nuclear program.
Rafael Grossi is the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency. For years, he's been trying to get Iran to provide answers about the uranium particles found at three sites and the chance that they were linked to Iran's nuclear program. There is no immediate comment from the Iranian government. The inspections issue is separate from the ongoing talks about the United States rejoining the 2015 International Pact to restrain Iran's nuclear program. Then U.S. President Donald Trump withdrew from the pact in 2018. Iran maintains that its nuclear program is for peaceful purposes. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken has welcomed a pledge by a shadow government in Myanmar to address discrimination and human rights abuses against minority Rohingya Muslims. Blinken said in a tweet on Sunday that the pledge by the National Unity Government is, quote, an important signal to all those working for an inclusive democratic future, end quote. The NUG has promised to repeal a 1982 law that denies citizenship to most Rohingya, and it says it is committed to repatriating more than 740,000 Rohingya who have fled to neighboring Bangladesh. Myanmar has been in turmoil since the military seized power in a February 1st coup, overthrowing a democratic government led by Aung San Suu Kyi. India has taken its COVID-19 vaccination drive to remote villages and nomadic tribes in the Himalayan region of Jammu and Kashmir territory. Reuters' Imra McCarthy reports.
Less than 5% of 950 million adult Indians have received the mandatory two vaccine doses. The landscape is a world away from the megacities which reopened for business on Monday, with long queues for buses in the financial hub of Mumbai, while traffic returned to the roads of New Delhi after the devastating second wave. Infections have now hit a two-month low, allowing authorities to reopen parts of the economy.
Reuters reporter Emer McCarthy. Amazon's billionaire founder Jeff Bezos says that he and his brother Mark will be among the first humans to fly on the first crewed spaceflight from his rocket company Blue Origin next month. Reuters' Conway G. Gittens has those details.
Billionaire Jeff Bezos has taken Amazon.com from a humble online bookseller into the stratosphere. And now that he's retiring from the CEO role, he's ready for his next adventure, a trip that's out of this world. Bezos announced Monday on Instagram that he and his brother will fly on the first crewed space flight from his rocket company Blue Origin, set for takeoff next month. In his post, Bezos wrote, quote, "Ever since I was 5 years old, I've dreamed of traveling to space. On July 20th, I will take that journey with my brother, the greatest adventure with my best friend." Bezos, who will officially end his tenure as Amazon CEO on July 5th, will be joined by the winner of an auction for a seat on Blue Origin's inaugural flight, which will mark a landmark moment in the competition to usher in a new era of private commercial space travel. The final round of that auction will be held in July. Blue Origin says the first round garnered more than 5,200 bidders from 136 countries. Bids for the second round of the auction currently top out at $2.8 million, according to the company's website. The travel plan is to fly more than 60 miles above Earth in a rocket and capsule combo. That's high enough to experience a few minutes of weightlessness and see the planet from afar.
It's time to go back to the moon.
Bezos is not the only billionaire with a passion for outer space and the cash to fund extra orbital ambitions. Elon Musk has SpaceX. It plans to send a 4-member crew into space later this year. And Richard Branson's Virgin Galactic aims to fly private customers to space starting next year. Bezos and Blue Origin are already planning to have more crewed flights before the end of this year, but have been tight-lipped on how much a seat on those flights will cost. Before that, the world's richest man is willing to use beautiful himself to prove the safety of the flights, even though the Blue Origin spacecraft that will carry Bezos into space has had 15 test flights. He will be on the company's first flight with humans on board, which will also give Bezos bragging rights over Musk and Branson.
Conway G. Gittins reports for Reuters News. And finally, In the Heights is a film about the dreams and struggles of the Latino community in New York's Washington Heights neighborhood. This film is Lin-Manuel Miranda's love letter to the place where he grew up. Of Puerto Rican descent, Miranda, who produced the film, is making a high-stakes bet that moviegoers will flock to the theaters this summer to watch this musical extravaganza after enduring months of self-isolation because of the COVID-19 pandemic. VOA's Penelope Pulu interviewed the cast as well as the filmmaker.
Dancing, singing to the tune of salsa and hip-hop makes director John Chu's film, In the Heights, a musical portrait of diversity in New York City's Latino neighborhood of Washington Heights. Once we get going, we never who made the hit film Crazy Rich Asians, spoke to VOA about the universal character of his new film.
I'm not from Washington Heights. I'm not from the East Coast. I'm all California kid growing up in a Chinese restaurant. And it spoke to me in so many ways of growing up in an immigrant community where your aunties and your uncles are taking care of you and putting their hopes and their dreams on you.
Responding to whether he, an Asian American, was the right fit to direct a story about Latin American immigrants, John Chu says as a first-generation American, the message inspired him.
I knew I could get us resources, spend money on casting it right, not trying to just get movie stars, because guess what? In the system that we have now, there aren't a lot of movie stars that represent a big swath of Latinx community because the talent isn't tapped because there are not as many roles.
Usnavi, played by Anthony Ramos, is the film's narrator and central figure in the intersecting stories of the neighborhood's residents. He's a bodega owner who dreams of returning to his home country, the Dominican Republic, only to find out that home has all along been in Washington Heights.
We had to assert our dignity in small ways.
Broadway veteran actress Olga Meredith plays Abuela Claudia, a reprise of the role she played when Lin-Manuel Miranda first created the musical for the stage in 2008.
This was his school project at Wesleyan that the director, the Broadway director Thomas Cale, picked up. What a creative genius and wonderful person and humanitarian and friend.
Jimmy Smith, one of the first Latino actors to break through in the 1980s, plays Kevin Rosario, a small business owner sacrificing for his daughter's education at Stanford University. Smith says after the pandemic, the country is ready for a life-asserting film.
As we open up as a society, it's a little bit of joy that we can give to people. So I hope people get to see it in movie theaters.
Corey Hawkins plays Benny, the only African-American in the community and in the film's cast.
I am also a part of that diaspora. It was just important to celebrate those differences and to fall in love with the community. And I did. I lived there when I was in school.
Vanessa, a fashion designer dreaming to make it big in Manhattan's fashion district, is played by Melissa Barrera. Vanessa is also Snavi's romantic interest.
The yearning of wanting to get out so that you can pursue your dreams is a very universal feeling. And also the blessing that that represents, to be able to be in a story that is going to uplift our community so much.
John Chu describes the film to VOA as a celebration of America.
All our challenges are different. However, the solutions are similar, of just sharing. Let's just share where we are. Let's share our music. Let's share our food. And when people walk out of that, they're going to want to know more. That's the first step of understanding each other, sharing.
Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
And you've been listening to International Edition. on The Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.